similar to that in the United States. Either ISI was complicit in sheltering a mass murderer, or it was incompetent. Yet it seemed clear that much or most of the Pakistani public was more offended by the fact that the SEALs had been able to penetrate the country's borders undetected than by the possibility that ISI had sheltered bin Laden. "Someone will have to answer," Munter said. Clinton, Panetta, and Gates outdid one another at the table, describing how dysfunctional America's relations with Pakistan had become. It wasn't just that the atmosphere was poisoned by mistrust. It had become almost impossible to get even minor work or accounting completed with the Pakistanis in an orderly way. Everything was frozen, broken, after the Raymond Davis affair. Intercepts of phone conversations by Kayani and Pasha after the Abbottabad raid had them sounding surprised about bin Laden's whereabouts, or pretending to be surprised, but also captured them expressing envy. "We should have this capability," Kayani said on one call. The Americans marveled. "We've been trying to train them up for counterinsurgency operations, including this kind of capability, but they have resisted mightily, as much from pride as anything else. Do they listen to anything we say?" "Look, we know Pakistan is dysfunctional," Obama finally said. "I take that as a given, the baseline. Let's work at what we can do. And let's stop trying to change their minds about where Pakistan's interests lie." With that, the president put the knife into the ambitions of the strategic dialogue and the Kayani memos, 1.0 through 3.0. There were just too many structural obstacles to transforming the relationship, Obama concluded. It was going to be transactional and difficult. Day by day that May, Kayani's position looked more and more precarious. Among the three-star generals in the Corps Commanders Conference who constituted his Privy Council, the feelings of anger and humiliation about the raid were described as the worst since the loss of East Pakistan to India in the 1971 war. These emotions were compounded by lingering resentment at the top of the officer corps over Kayani's decision to extend his term as Army Chief the previous autumn. Intercepts and other reporting showed that senior three-star Pakistani generals at the corps level really wanted Kayani out. On Friday, May 13th, Kayani and Pasha, accompanied by a deputy chief of Air Force Operations, arrived at Parliament House on Constitution Avenue in Islamabad's section of broad avenues and grand public buildings. Parliament House was a modern, boxy, white building designed by an American architect and opened 25 years earlier. The general sat in an ornate, carpeted chamber before about 400 senators and members of the National Assembly. Kayani opened with one of his standard PowerPoint briefings, talking over slides that reminded the parliamentarians of how many thousands of Pakistani soldiers and civilians had died in terrorist attacks since 2001. And how many al-Qaeda leaders the army, ISI, and police had arrested. After the PowerPoint, Pasha did most of the talking. He said Pakistan's relationship with the United States had gone bad, and they would now reassert themselves. "They want to take action on their own, on our soil," he said. "We will not allow their boots on our ground." The Americans had conducted a sting operation on us with the raid on Abbottabad. Yet the problem was one of military capabilities, and if the United States wanted to conduct such a raid again, they might succeed. Pasha offered to resign at one point. "I present myself for accountability before any forum, including Parliament," he said. "There was no intentional negligence, but an aspect of failure is there. ISI should have known where bin Laden was," he admitted. 6 days later, Kayani appeared at National Defense University on the edge of Islamabad, across from a golf club. The main building had an auditorium with a long horseshoe-shaped table. Kayani sat down by himself in full dress uniform, with only a file of papers, a glass of water, and an ashtray. He told 80 or so officers and civilian faculty they could ask anything they wished. He lit a cigarette. "If they don't trust us, how can we trust them?" a colonel asked about the United States. "In uniform, we tend to see everything in black and white," Kayani answered. "In the real world, there are a lot of gray areas, and you have to deal with it." He described Pakistan as a mortgaged house, with the United States in the role of banker. "We are helpless," he professed. "Can we fight the United States?" The solution was to strengthen the economy and to raise taxes domestically so they could end their dependence on Washington and its allies. By late May, American intelligence reports showed that Kayani and Pasha had opened vigorous discussions about how to break off the relationship with America and reorganize around Pakistan's alliance with China. How could they raise money from alternative sources? How could they build their own Chinese-inspired economy with surpluses that could be reinvested in defense? The Obama administration officials who read accounts of these conversations figured that some of the posturing was deliberately constructed for American eavesdroppers to caution the United States, but that some of it was probably a genuine search for alternatives. There was little room for Kayani to act precipitously. The Pakistani state and its bloated military depended on American, European, Japanese, South Korean, and Australian aid, as well as loans from the International Monetary Fund to avoid bankruptcy. There might come a day when Chinese-led finance could replace those flows, but it hadn't arrived yet. For the Chinese Communist Party leadership, Pakistan remained an essential ally, a rare friend, and a long-term check on India. Yet the Chinese government had grown as exhausted by Pakistani dysfunction as the United States had. After the May 4th meeting in the Situation Room, Obama's national security team decided to try to embrace Pakistan rather than repudiate its army or ISI. The CIA's drone campaign against al-Qaeda and its allies in Waziristan depended on tacit Pakistani permission, and supply lines to American troops in Afghanistan ran through Pakistani territory. For all its failings, Kayani's army had fought to reduce violence and restore some stability since Pakistan's low point of 2009, and the cabinet did not want to see the Pakistani Taliban revive. Doug Lute, Mark Grossman, and Hillary Clinton in particular also hoped that bin Laden's death might shift the ground favorably in talks with the Taliban. It would certainly make it easier, in a political sense, to carry out the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan that Obama had pre-announced at his West Point speech almost 18 months earlier. In the documents seized at Abbottabad, they soon found evidence that around 2010, Tayyip Aga had traveled from Quetta to deliver a message in person to bin Laden from the Taliban leadership. Essentially, the message was, when we return to power in Afghanistan, all things being equal, it would be a good idea if you did not come with us. And if you do come, you will have to maintain a very low profile. This reinforced the hope that the Taliban might be willing to break with al-Qaeda in a comprehensive peace deal. On his initial visit to Pakistan after the raid, which had been previously scheduled, Mark Grossman met with Brigadier Saad Muhammad, a former ISI station chief in Kabul, who was part of a Pakistani delegation designated to talk regularly to the Americans. "What goes on in the ISI mind?" Saad asked out loud. The ISI had given a concrete proposal to Karzai in April to build a new relationship with Pakistan, which could deliver the Taliban to talks. Now, with bin Laden dead, you and others who favor negotiation will be stronger, the brigadier advised. Biden worked the telephone to Islamabad. Michael Morell at the CIA, John Kerry, Mullen, and Clinton flew to Pakistan to try to start to repair the relationship. Morell met Pasha alone at the ISI director's home. The first 15 or so minutes were awkward to the point of palpable discomfort. No one knew what to say. Pasha complained about the CIA's unwillingness to share what it knew about bin Laden at Abbottabad, and about the Pentagon's unwillingness to inform them about the raid. Morrell expressed frustration about ISI's long-standing work with extremists. He said the Obama administration could not share its secrets about bin Laden because they believed the information might leak and that bin Laden would walk away, which was unacceptable. After 15 minutes, they started talking once more about where to go from here. Pasha called Army House and escorted Morrell to a meeting with Kayani after midnight. Both sides felt freer to gripe. The Pakistanis pointed out that the administration was still keeping them in the dark about its talks with the Taliban, a subject of vital interest to them. "What's the big picture?" Hussein Haqqani asked Pasha during this period. "We're a small country," he answered. "They are the big ones. We have to keep our pride. We have to outmaneuver them. It's all about being smart." Chapter 31. Fight and Talk. Frank Ruggiero, Jeff Hayes, and Chris Colenda flew back to Munich in the days following bin Laden's death. They rehearsed for a negotiation with Tayyip Aga, with Colenda playing the Taliban envoy. They discussed how to use bin Laden's killing as leverage. The men met Tayyip Aga in the German safe house on May 7, 2011. Ruggiero urged Aga to see bin Laden's killing as an opening for the Taliban to break with al-Qaeda. "This is a historic opportunity for you to correct your mistakes," Ruggiero said. Tayyip Aga asked the Americans to define more precisely what a Taliban break with al-Qaeda would entail. The American side later delivered a non-paper. Tayyip Aga said it might take time for him to get firm guidance from the Taliban's underground leadership. "We communicate by courier," he said dryly. "Finding good couriers is becoming more difficult after the events of May 1st. They returned to Tayyip Aga's demand that the United States release senior Taliban prisoners. The Americans informed him that releasing senior leaders from Guantanamo was a non-starter. Michael Steiner, the German envoy, thought that Aga was willing to compromise and that the Americans were too cautious. The American negotiators worried that Aga might be using the talks solely for prisoner releases, with no real intention to explore a political compromise to end the war or reduce its violence. Aga seemed agitated about the prisoner issue. At one point, he left the room. One member of the American team heard him throwing up in the bathroom. They thought he might be so upset about the stalemate over prisoners that it had made him sick, but of course, they could not rule out an aversion to Bavarian food. The Americans were prepared to continue discussions about a Taliban political office. The politics around prisoner releases in the United States looked treacherous. An office to pursue peace might be easier. The Taliban's prospective political office had to be located in Qatar, Tayyip Aga insisted as the talks went on. "This was a position expressing Taliban foreign policy," he explained. The Taliban's political commission had decided it would not open an office in any country that had military forces in Afghanistan, in any neighboring country, or in any country where the presence of such an office might cause a backlash against the movement. Choosing Saudi Arabia, for example, would provoke a negative reaction from Iran. The governments of the United Arab Emirates and Turkey were too close to Pakistan. It had to be Qatar. The American team had decided beforehand to accept this demand, in part because they were not prepared yet to accommodate prisoner exchanges, Tayyip Aga's other priority. A week after the Munich meeting, Der Spiegel and the Washington Post carried accounts of the talks and published Tayyip Aga's name for the first time. Furious, the envoy informed the Americans through his Qatari intermediaries that he was suspending negotiations. Grossman, Lute, and others in the conflict resolution cell sought to signal their regret about the leaks, which were inevitable given the divisions about the talks within the Obama administration and the Karzai regime. Hillary Clinton instructed Ruggiero to fly to Qatar to deliver a message that they wanted to get back on track. The Qataris soon replied that Tayyip Aga was willing to meet, at least informally. Ruggiero and Hayes flew back to Doha during the first week of July, to the Shark Resort Hotel, a Ritz-Carlton property. It featured sharks in its decorating themes. They met Sheikh Faisal bin Qasim Al Thani, a member of the Qatari royal family, who had been working as an informal interlocutor with the Taliban. Later, Tayyip Aga joined them. He handed the Americans a one-page, unsigned, typed letter in fractured English, with the bold-faced word, message, as its header. It was a letter, the envoy explained, from Mullah Muhammad Omar to President Obama. It said, in essence, that both leaders had to manage domestic political risks to seek a settlement of their war, but that Omar was willing to be courageous, and Obama should be as well. I made the important decisions for the sake of humanity and a desire to stop the casualties on both sides for peace in the country and for good relations between the two countries after the complete withdrawal of your forces from Afghanistan. The letter began. It rankled, Mullah Omar or his ghostwriter continued, that because the Taliban had extended an olive branch, this was dismissed by the United States as a sign of our weakness or subordination, as said by high-ranking officials in your government. He was apparently referring to how Gates, Petraeus, and other officials were quoted in the press. The Taliban had made significant concessions already, the letter continued. These had negative aspects for us, and yet I made them in order to get the above-mentioned objectives, that is, peace and American withdrawal. Now it was time for President Obama to step up. I have acknowledged the legitimate hurdles you face regarding Guantanamo prisoners, but still you have to make important and tough decisions in order to get what you have been calling for years. The letter said that Mullah Omar would guarantee that released Taliban prisoners would not return to the war. I am determined to what I have said in this regard, and I will stick to my words, promises, without hypocrisy. We are in the stage of confidence building, and still there is a way to get to the stage of negotiations, the letter continued. We should both listen to each other carefully and act honestly and sincerely, so that we will have positive impacts on our negotiations in the future. The Obama administration's willingness to allow the Taliban to open a political office in Qatar is a positive step, and I hope you will take steps for the release and transfer of Guantanamo prisoners and the elimination of sanctions and travel bans on Taliban leaders, as these are the necessary steps required for confidence building. It appeared to be the first direct communication from the Taliban's leadership to an American president since NATO's war in Afghanistan began a decade earlier. Of course, everything about Mullah Omar's whereabouts and independence from ISI was a mystery. Nobody could say for sure who had authored the letter. Tayyip Aga agreed to start talking to the Americans again. They would meet again in Doha the following month. Amid the satisfaction and high public standing the Obama administration enjoyed after knocking off bin Laden, there was rising hope at the White House, even confidence, that they might be on a path to negotiating an end to the war. I'm building on what Holbrooke created, trying to take it to the next level, Mark Grossman told Prince Mukreen, the Saudi intelligence chief, around this time. President Obama and Secretary Clinton are both serious about the talks. To be fair, Grossman added, a ceasefire is some time away. We have to be sure that they stop suicide bombing and attacking women's schools. With a State Department colleague that summer, Grossman was less cautious. Sometime in 2012, he predicted, I'm going to get all these guys on an island off the coast of Turkey and hammer out a deal. In Islamabad, Ruggiero briefed Kayani about the negotiations, but told the general only about half of what he was up to. His reticence had a logic. The conflict resolution cell believed that if a peace negotiation about Afghanistan's future did become serious, the American side would, in effect, be negotiating against ISI, which would be aligned with the Taliban, even if it did not control them fully. They could not afford to be too forthcoming in advance about U.S. positions. Kayani and Pasha remained insistent. If you want peace, you should be talking to the Haqqanis. Ruggiero disclosed that he would be willing to meet Ibrahim Haqqani for exploratory conversations. For most of Obama's war cabinet, the idea of talking to the Haqqanis as part of a peace process remained anathema. The network had the blood of Americans on its hands. Without question, the network remorselessly slaughtered Afghan civilians in terrorist attacks in Kabul and elsewhere. It had collaborated with ISI to kill Indian civilians, diplomats, and military officers. It had collaborated with bin Laden since al-Qaeda's birth. Yet President Obama noted that the Haqqanis were different from al-Qaeda. They lived in the region. It was their home. They were not foreign implants. They could not simply be wiped out. The Haqqanis were part of the Taliban. Both they and the Taliban leadership said so, and Obama had authorized ambitious confidence-building talks with the Taliban's envoy. Why should the Haqqanis belong to a different category from the Quetta Shura? On August 10th, a few weeks after receiving the letter from Mullah Muhammad Omar, Frank Ruggiero and Jeff Hayes met Ibrahim Haqqani in a room at an Egyptian-themed hotel in Dubai. Clinton and Obama had sanctioned this meeting. Ahmed Pasha, the ISI director, also greeted Ruggiero. As they talked, Pasha translated between English and Urdu. Haqqani thanked the United States for supporting the Mujahideen during their war of resistance against the Soviet Union. Without that support, they could not have prevailed. He added that the Taliban, including the Haqqanis, were not enemies of the United States, but were only fighting against a foreign occupation. And he undermined ISI's claim that the Haqqanis were essential to any negotiation. Ibrahim said that the only official channel for peace talks with the Taliban ran through Tayyip Aga. His purpose with the Americans seemed to be to press for the release of a pair of Haqqani network commanders held at Bagram. Overall, the conversation proved desultory. Ibrahim did not seem very well briefed about what might be possible in negotiations with the United States. He rambled about how the attempted car bombing at Times Square the previous spring had been an al-Qaeda operation. After the meeting, Clinton rebuked Kayani for having Pasha in the room, for not clearing that decision in advance. The Pakistanis were puzzled. Pasha believed that he had made it clear he would attend, and he did not understand why the Americans would choose to make an issue of it. Wounded and puzzled, Pasha and Kayani updated their grievances. They had been trying to do the Americans a favor. Yes, Ibrahim Haqqani was not a major commander, but Pasha's plan was to hold two meetings with the family representative and then move to someone higher in the network. Why did there never seem to be room in Washington to give Pakistan the benefit of a doubt? Obama shuffled his national security cabinet in the summer of 2011. Gates retired from the Pentagon. Obama asked Panetta to move there from the CIA, and he decided to appoint Petraeus to replace Panetta. The Obama administration had taken a beating in the 2010 midterm election. There were rumors that Petraeus, a registered Republican, might be induced to run for president in 2012. Petraeus had insisted forcefully to Rahm Emanuel, Obama's influential first chief of staff, that he had no interest. "Look, get it through your head. I'm not going to run for office. Mark my words." He repeated this privately to anyone who asked him. Yet politics was an unpredictable business. The CIA's leadership was a glamorous position, and it offered a way to keep Petraeus inside the administration's fold as the 2012 election arrived. Four-star military commanders had a mixed record as CIA directors, certainly in the eyes of career agency employees. General Michael Hayden had been mostly successful, despite military airs that sometimes rankled at Langley. Career officers regarded Admiral Stansfield Turner, Jimmy Carter's CIA director, as a stiff-necked prisoner of military culture, an outsider who never connected. By the time a typical general or admiral had his third star pinned on, he had become accustomed to the military's distinctly deferential protocols, red carpet travel, and entourages of bag carriers and communication aides. The CIA was a flatter, quirkier organization. The agency was part university campus, part mad science lab, part undercover police force, part paranoid internal affairs department, and part militia. Petraeus had spent his entire adult life in military service, and he had spent the last decade as a highly political general and as an international celebrity. Soon after he arrived on the seventh floor, Petraeus issued instructions to the kitchen about his highly fastidious runner's diet, heavy on shrimp and quinoa. He went on long bike rides on the weekends with his security detail, expecting his aides to keep him well hydrated. There were plenty of fitness fanatics at the CIA, but the cigar-chomping George Tenet or the wine connoisseur Leon Panetta were more of a piece with clandestine service habits of living. And there was not a civilian bureaucracy in Washington that did not relish taking down a leader who had airs. Still, the resentment of Petraeus was rarely more serious than eye-rolling. For his part, Petraeus seemed thrilled to be at the CIA. He read into special access program files that he previously knew little or nothing about, even as a top Central Command general, clandestine operations in Iran, the Arab world, and elsewhere. At dinner with former Pentagon colleagues, he expressed the enthusiasm of a college student. "You wouldn't believe all the things we are doing." What Petraeus lacked in self-awareness, he often made up for with political savvy. As a commanding general in Iraq, at Central Command, and in Afghanistan, he had become a master in what spin doctors called strategic engagement. He placed longtime allies from his Pentagon brain trust as fellows in Washington think tanks. He regularly accepted off-the-record lunch and dinner invitations from journalists, public policy scholars, and editorial boards. Petraeus intended to do less of this at the CIA and to stay off the Sunday television talk shows. But one evening in August, the president of the Brookings Institution, Strobe Talbot, hosted a private dinner for Petraeus to reintroduce the general as the country's top spy. Talbot invited about 15 newspaper columnists and think tank types. Petraeus arrived a little late with his biographer, Paula Broadwell, with whom Petraeus happened to be embarking on a secret affair. "She seems to think I'm worth a book," he remarked. At the large table, he invited each guest to ask him one question. He was candid about a few personalities, but overall said little that he would not have testified to at a congressional hearing. He gave statistics purporting to document that NATO was winning the Afghan war. He defended the CIA's drone program in the federally administered tribal areas. Petraeus sought to disarm White House and State Department critics of the Counterterrorism Center's drone operations. He assured Cameron Munter, the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, that he would never call him out or embarrass him during an interagency meeting, as Panetta had once done. Petraeus also assured Munter that the Counterterrorism Center would bring him into their targeting and decision-making process much earlier, to identify and resolve problems before they escalated into an interagency fight. Even if they did not always follow the ambassador's advice, they would respect his role. When Munter found himself back in Washington, he was surprised to receive an invitation to have lunch with Petraeus in the CIA director's dining room on the seventh floor. An escort walked Munter past the museum space on the ground floor of old headquarters. The CIA's curators had installed a cheesy diorama of a paramilitary scene in Afghanistan, using wax figures to depict two CIA officers and two Afghan guerrillas in Panjshiri hats. A little later, The CIA curators installed a display of the AK-47 rifle that had been in bin Laden's bedroom when he was killed. Upstairs, Munter found Mark Kelton, the Islamabad station chief with whom he had clashed repeatedly. Kelton had left Islamabad soon after the killing of Osama bin Laden, suffering from an acute stomach illness that caused him to lose 40 pounds. Some at the CIA suspected, but could not prove, that ISI had poisoned him. Kelton told colleagues that he did not know what to think. It might have been natural causes. He recovered fully. Now Kelton stood by as Petraeus presented Munter with a service medal in recognition of his contributions to the country. It was vintage Petraeus, ceremony as influence. Career intelligence analysts at the CIA and across the administration who were working on Afghanistan greeted the Petraeus era at Langley with particular anxiety. The analysts responsible for the annual secret national intelligence estimate about the progress of the Afghan war had earlier battled Petraeus, when he was commanding general at ISAF, over what they regarded as his undue optimism. Since 2007, the annual NIE had reached negative judgments about the Afghan war every single year. In late 2010, from Kabul, Petraeus had written an 8-page dissent letter arguing that the analysts were wrong and that he was executing his military campaign plan successfully. It was not unusual for commanding generals to see wars they ran more optimistically than professional intelligence analysts in Washington. While in command of the surge into Iraq, Petraeus had formally dissented from a national intelligence estimate in 2007 for being too negative and for not including late-breaking data from the battlefield that he thought showed progress. He had also dissented the following year because he felt the intelligence community was too positive about the gains the forces he commanded had made in Iraq. Now, as the analysts prepared the 2011 NIE on Afghanistan, which was to consider scenarios for the country until 2014, the analysts were again in conflict with Petraeus's successors in the ISAF military command over how well things were going. The estimate's authors were moving toward 6 key judgments, none of them encouraging. One was that the next group of political leaders to follow Karzai would be corrupt and unlikely to improve governance. Another was that the goal of establishing capable Afghan national security forces at the scale America had planned might not be viable. The CIA's assessment was highly skeptical that the Afghan security forces could be as effective against the Taliban as ISAF commanders predicted, although they stopped short of predicting an outright collapse of the Afghan National Army. One resource for the 2011 NIE was the CIA's district assessments, the top-secret, color-coded maps of Afghanistan depicting areas of government control, Taliban control, and local control. These were still produced twice a year by Tony Scanella's small group of career analysts. As of late 2011, they depicted an eroding stalemate with the Taliban. Petraeus criticized the CIA maps, believing that they understated American military gains. He called the Green Zone of the Argandab, where Art Kandarian's brigade task force had paid such a heavy price in lives and limbs the previous year, transformed. The intelligence community did not give these gains enough credence, he argued. It was true that the Taliban had been cleared out of many of the grape and marijuana fields where the foot patrols of the 101st Airborne Task Force had slogged, and that Kandahar City was more secure. It was also true that the ink spot premise of the military campaign plan, to concentrate forces to defend major Afghan cities, except in Helmand where they attacked the drug economy, had successfully reinforced security in big population centers. Yet other important hypotheses of the military plan had not worked out. Reintegration, the idea that battered Taliban commanders would defect en masse to the Karzai government, had not materialized. Petraeus told colleagues that he had tried his best to replicate the Sons of Iraq success from the surge there, but they just did not have the resources. By 2011, only 5,400 ragged Taliban fighters had come into the reintegration program, by one ISAF estimate, and some of those seemed to be scammers looking for payoffs. That summer, Robert Williams, who had become Peter Lavoie's successor as National Intelligence Officer for South Asia, traveled with U.S. Special Forces for 3 weeks in Helmand, Kandahar, and Uruzgan, conducting more than 50 interviews with Afghan leaders and civilians. He was leading Petraeus's CIA Red Team to provide counterintuitive or original analysis on hard problems. He wanted to understand the arc of history in Helmand, from King Zahir Shah in the 1960s to the present. The Afghans he met had very low expectations of any government, including the Taliban's shadow government. New Afghan and foreign occupying regimes entered into their districts and villages from time to time, made extravagant promises, and then became exploitive one after another, one decade after another. NATO and its corrupt Afghan allies, in the form of predatory local police and governors, were only the latest example. In a village in southern Helmand, Williams met officers of a local police force that had recently apprehended a criminal. They told him they had handed the suspect to the Taliban to be tried by one of the movement's shadow religious courts, because they thought the outcome would be more just than if they sent him to the corruption-riddled district center. The civilians Williams interviewed were not really looking for good government. That seemed beyond imagining. They were fashioning least bad choices within families, villages, and sub-tribes to protect themselves from both Karzai regime and Taliban-aligned predators. That often involved straddling the U.S.-Taliban war, with some sons enlisted in the Taliban militias and others on the government payroll. Williams heard sympathy for the Taliban's ideology and respect for the movement's swift, if ruthless, shadow courts. He heard accounts of the Taliban's complaint system and anecdotes about abusive Taliban commanders who were sometimes removed after citizens protested. The Taliban were embedded. They were certainly not defeated. Mark Grossman met Tayyip Aga in person for the first time late that summer in Doha. By dispatching Grossman, the Americans signaled that they were ready to elevate the negotiations to a new level, as Mullah Muhammad Omar's message had urged. Grossman now experienced for himself the odd rhythm of talking to Tayyip Aga. Typically, at the negotiating sessions, the Qatari mediators first met separately with the American delegation and served tea. Then Tayyip Aga would arrive, typically wearing a white shalwar kameez, a traditional gown. They assembled in a meeting room to talk across a table for an hour or two. Tayyip Aga usually opened with a prepared statement. Open discussion followed. The Qataris by now took copious notes, as did Tayyip Aga, as did American aides supporting Grossman. Later they would all have a buffet dinner on the compound, mingling and having more informal chats. Grossman opened his first encounter with Tayyip Aga by introducing himself, a little about his career, and then laying out the Obama administration's vision for Afghanistan. He talked about the calendar of major donor conferences and intergovernmental political discussions to support the Karzai government. "We hope the Taliban will be part of it," he said. "Afghanistan will be better. If the Taliban make the right choices, they can be part of it." He explained that he wanted to advance a sequence of confidence-building and negotiating steps that would create a path for the Taliban to join Afghanistan's future. Tayyip Aga replied, in essence, that he wasn't very interested in all of these plans. The Taliban would not be at the intergovernmental meetings. They were not members of NATO. He spoke dismissively about Karzai. He turned the discussion quickly to his effort to win the releases of the 5 senior Taliban prisoners at Guantanamo. That continued to seem to be his principal purpose. The Americans continued to prioritize finding a way toward an agreement on a political office for the Taliban. They went into more discussion about what the rules for such an office might be and how they would proceed step by step. Over dinner and in subsequent meetings, Grossman tried to plumb Tayyip Aga's motivations. He had read voluminous intelligence analysis about the envoy, but now he tried to ask about his personal history, his family. "We have a job to do," Grossman told him. "It seems to me that if we do our work, less people will die. I want to understand if that is your motivation, too." Yet he found the answer elusive. Remarks Tayyip Aga made fed a library of restricted conflict resolution cell cables and memos. It was an eclectic, curious compendium of thoughts and positions. The Taliban envoy said the Afghans were naturally democratic, and that the Taliban would win an election if the vote were truly free and fair. He also said, "We recognize the problems from the past, and we have to have qualified people within the government when the Taliban return to power. We have to have good relationships with the outside world. We have to have better relationships with all the Afghan ethnicities, not just Pashtuns. Our leadership in Pakistan sends their girls to school and even to university," he remarked one time. "We recognize that this is important for families and important for society." He was expansive about the possibilities for a political transition as the American forces withdrew. "We cannot afford to have another power vacuum like what happened when the Soviets left," he said, "which had triggered a civil war. Whatever agreement comes about, it's going to have to be enforced and monitored. So some kind of international peacekeeping force might be needed. We need to have positive relations with the United States and with the international community, because we tried governing once as an outcast, and it didn't work out very well." Whenever the subject of September 11th came up, Tayyip Aga reverted to a talking point. "We inherited these people," he said, referring to bin Laden and al-Qaeda. "They had told us they were not going to do these kinds of attacks, and that they had nothing to do with September 11th. We told you that we would investigate this and hold them accountable if needed, but that wasn't good enough for you." The Arabs were fellow Muslims. The Taliban couldn't just disown them. About Pakistan, Tayyip Aga was openly disdainful. "Yes, we live there, but we are an independent movement, and we don't respond to what Pakistan wants to do." At some sessions, Tayyip Aga brought along an aide, Sher Mohammad Abbas Stanikzai, a former deputy minister during the Islamic Emirate. Michael Steiner, the German diplomat, still appeared as well. At one session, the Americans listened with bemusement as Stanikzai uncorked an extemporaneous rant about how perfidious the Americans had been over the years, whereas Germany had always been a great and reliable friend of Afghanistan. To show appreciation, Steiner got up from one side of the table and sat down next to Stanikzai. Just then the Taliban leader turned to the subject of the Second World War. He pointed out that Afghanistan had been a staunch ally of Adolf Hitler's against America and Britain. Steiner froze, betraying as little dismay as possible. The Americans found the scene a little funny. Of course, they didn't associate Steiner with Nazism, but Steiner was shocked and embarrassed. These things happened from time to time to German diplomats, and it was always hard to take. Grossman returned from his first direct engagement with Tayyip Aga, convinced that the two sides were making progress. He told colleagues that he expected the Taliban to have their political office in Qatar opened within a few months. As the 10th anniversary of September 11th approached, the Haqqani Network organized attack squads to strike directly at American targets in Afghanistan. On September 10th, a truck bomb detonated at a NATO base south of Kabul, killing 5 American soldiers and wounding more than 6 dozen. But for luck, the death toll could have been much higher. On September 13th, a Haqqani squad infiltrated Kabul and struck the U.S. Embassy with mortars and assault rifles. The battle went on for hours. No Americans were killed, but five Afghan police died. ISAF intelligence sources had warned of the Haqqani's truck bomb plan about 6 weeks before it occurred. But they and the CIA could not pinpoint the truck itself as it rolled into Afghanistan. At one point, Admiral Mullen called Kayani and asked him to stop the attack. Kayani said he would try, but how could he locate a single truck in all of North Waziristan? Didn't the Americans have a better chance with their technical surveillance? When the attack finally occurred and lives were lost, the Americans were even more aggravated than usual. They had warned ISI and held the service responsible. The two deadly Kabul attacks also coincided with secret intelligence reports emanating from ISI. It held that Mullah Zaif, the former Taliban ambassador to Pakistan and Guantanamo prisoner, now living in Kabul, had facilitated an American visa for an al-Qaeda operative. The operative, in turn, had joined a plot to carry out car bombings in New York and Washington to mark 10 years since 9/11. The reporting stretched credulity. How could Zaif, a known Taliban founder living under Karzai's protection in Kabul, help anyone obtain an American visa? Yet once such specific threat reporting seeped into the American intelligence system, it could be self-propagating, unless it could be affirmatively disproved. Based on the report, the Department of Homeland Security issued heightened warnings and extra New York police poured into the streets. American forces raided Zaif's home in South Kabul. He happened to be away. The threat information passed by ISI turned out to be false. The Haqqani attacks on Kabul that September infuriated Obama's war cabinet, however. Marine General James Mattis had taken over Central Command, in charge of U.S. military forces in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. His deputy was Admiral Robert Harward, a Navy SEAL who had served multiple tours in Afghanistan. They saw the Haqqani strikes as a game-changer. That month, Obama's national security principals embarked on a near-daily series of meetings to coordinate pressure on Kayani, to deter further attacks, and to try to force the general to do something at last about the sanctuary in North Waziristan. The CIA, ISAF, and the NSA had by now accumulated a rich portfolio of evidence about ISI relations with Sirajuddin Haqqani, his brother Badruddin, and other active network commanders. Cell phone intercepts of Badruddin Haqqani made clear that his forces had carried out the truck bomb strike and the embassy assault in September. However, the intercepts did not provide evidence of direct ISI participation. Yet it was clear that the Haqqanis operated with concrete Pakistani support. The Americans had evidence that the Pakistan Army transported the Haqqanis to Rawalpindi for meetings, and that these discussions concerned military operations in Afghanistan. Mark Grossman told Kayani that the United States was suspending direct talks with Ibrahim Haqqani. Yet the envoy also told Kayani that the American policy still ultimately sought inclusive negotiations among all Afghans. Grossman explained further that the United States would continue to seek the death or capture of Haqqani leaders unless they wanted to reconcile with the Karzai government. Kayani was incredulous. "You can't say to the Haqqanis, 'If you don't come here to talk, we'll blow your brains out.'" But that was, in fact, the American position. Grossman and his colleagues thought Kayani was missing the point. The attack on the American embassy crossed a line. Kayani had to do everything possible to bring his Directorate-esque clients under control. It got worse. On September 23rd, a Taliban assassin with a bomb rigged inside his turban visited the home of Burhanuddin Rabbani, the 71-year-old leader of the Jamiat-e-Islami party in Afghanistan, and the de facto political leader of the old Northern Alliance. The assassin bent in greeting, detonated himself, and killed Rabbani. Hamid Karzai had appointed Rabbani to lead his High Peace Council, a body of diverse Afghan figures that Karzai hoped might eventually explore a peace deal with the Taliban perhaps in concert with European and American negotiations, such as the Obama administration's secret channel with Tayyip Aga. The attack infuriated him. Karzai was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly meetings. Michael Steiner met him there. Karzai signaled that he might have to shut off talks with the Taliban because the killing of Rabbani might be unforgivable for Karzai's allies in the old Northern Alliance. The attack also wounded Massoum Stanikzai, one of Karzai's most important advisors on peace negotiations. It took Stanikzai months to recover from his wounds in a hospital in India, which removed a steady voice about the Taliban conundrum from Karzai's inner circle during a critical time. The Taliban kept escalating their strikes in Kabul, and the Americans kept hoping that Kayani would do something about it. That month, Kayani held another round of long one-on-one conversations with Obama's top advisors. In Abu Dhabi, Kayani met Tom Donilon, the National Security Advisor. In Seville, at a NATO meeting, he talked for hours with Mike Mullen. This was their 27th face-to-face conversation. Kayani asked four questions. If there were to be peace talks, who among the Taliban is judged to be reconcilable and who is not? Who does what in the negotiating process? What is the sequencing? And what are the timelines for achieving reductions in violence or a political settlement? The White House composed a classified paper for Kayani to address these questions. The general said he appreciated the paper, yet his meetings with American officials volleyed back and forth between planning for peace talks and threats about ISI's role. "We're at a crossroads," Donilon warned Kayani. If the Haqqani truck bomb had killed 70 American soldiers, the U.S. military would have again attacked inside Pakistan in response, he said. If the Haqqanis continue to hit American targets, you've really turned your fate over to the network, he warned. Mullen was scheduled to testify to the Senate Armed Services Committee on September 22nd. In the principals' meetings about the Haqqanis that month, Mullen had heard Hillary Clinton denounce the enemy in bloodthirsty language. "We ought to hang every one of them," she had said. Mullen found her remarks bracing, and even a little inspiring. Mullen knew that, because of his visible relationship with Kayani, he was in a distinctive position to declare publicly that ISI had crossed the line. He decided to speak out. With ISI support, Haqqani operatives planned and conducted that truck bomb attack, as well as the assault on our embassy, Mullen testified to the Senate committee. The Haqqani network acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. The testimony made headlines. To Mullen's dismay, Clinton and Grossman expressed surprise at his statements. Surprise that he had seemed surprised by some revelation that ISI backed Haqqani violence. President Obama also told aides that he thought Mullen was grandstanding. Obama remained firmly committed to the negotiating track with Tayyip Aga. He didn't want it undermined gratuitously. On October 19, 2011, Hillary Clinton flew into Kabul on an unannounced visit. With Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador, she met Hamid Karzai at the palace. "This has been a tough year," Clinton acknowledged. There had been many casualties suffered by the Afghan security forces, and many killings of Afghan civilians, mainly by the Taliban, but also in mistaken actions by NATO forces. "We feel for you," she said. "The Afghan people are united," Karzai told her. "All of them are angry at Pakistan. I'm under immense pressure to do something. Pakistan is the address. How far is the U.S. willing to go?" "We're willing to take the fight to Pakistan," Clinton assured him. She pointed to the CIA drone war in Waziristan. "Yet we also have to talk," Clinton went on. "We have to structure peace negotiations. We want transparency and to have Afghans in the room." "Pakistan will also have to be there," she said. "How do we structure the process of talking and fighting?" Clinton told Karzai about the most recent meeting with Tayyip Aga. There were difficulties, but they were still negotiating for a possible 5-to-1 exchange of prisoners. The 5 senior Taliban detainees at Guantanamo, in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. If that deal was successful, then Mullah Mansour, Omar's deputy, would lead substantive Taliban negotiations about the war and the future of Afghan politics. "It has to happen more quickly," Karzai said. "Put a lot more pressure on Pakistan," he advised. "Stir up the Pashtuns. They should realize they're being used as a tool by Pakistan to hurt Afghanistan." Clinton flew on to Islamabad. She met Kayani. Her message was, "We can't get off of talk and fight. This is our policy. We know you think it's contradictory, but we don't." Clinton tried to convince Kayani that the Obama administration was unified on both the fight and talk tracks. But Kayani and his advisers, particularly the savvy Washington watcher Maliha Lodi, had their own reading. She judged that the White House and the State Department were more invested in a serious exit negotiation with the Taliban than the Pentagon or the CIA, which hoped to fight on. With all the high-level American visitors tromping through Islamabad, Kayani and Lodi had their own exposure to Obama's interagency diversity, one principle at a time. Kayani told Clinton that America had to determine when fight and talk could converge into a single policy. "You have to consider ways that you get some kind of mutual reduction in violence," he insisted. "That would be more conducive to a peace process than opening a high-level Taliban office in Qatar," he added. Clinton tried to clarify the messages Mattis and Donilon had delivered the previous month. "We're not talking about a large military operation against the Haqqanis," she said. "Can't you just squeeze them?" "The clarity has to come on the bigger issues," Kayani demurred, "meaning how negotiations might end the war and create regional stability. Then the Haqqanis are a part of that." Soon after Clinton returned to Washington, Tayyip Aga delivered the biggest breakthrough yet. He handed over a proof-of-life video showing that Bo Bergdahl was still in one piece in Haqqani custody. The video galvanized the conflict resolution cell at the White House. Here was proof that Tayyip Aga, without ever leaving Qatar, had the ability to communicate even with the Haqqanis. And here was a chance for the Obama administration to bring America's only formal known prisoner of war home. The video persuaded the White House to move forward with preparations for a prisoner swap, despite the political risks. J. Johnson, the Pentagon's top lawyer, negotiated with Qatar's attorney general on a memorandum of understanding that would lay out how the Varsity Five at Guantanamo would be controlled if they were released to Qatar's care. Leon Panetta, now Secretary of Defense, faced a legal requirement imposed by the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, the main defense spending bill, to certify under his signature that the released prisoners would not pose a threat to American civilians. Overall, analysts outside the Pentagon thought the risk was reasonable to bear. The 5 Taliban had been out of the war for a decade. They could negotiate and enforce close monitoring. But the standard in the law was a high bar, and the decision weighed on Panetta. On a Sunday in mid-November, Dennis McDonough, then the Deputy National Security Advisor, called Johnson, counterterrorism advisor John Brennan, and other senior officials to the Situation Room to review the case files of the 5 senior Taliban prisoners. Harold Coe, the State Department's top lawyer, Avril Haines, the top national security lawyer at the White House, and Michael Morell, the deputy CIA director, attended. Frank Ruggiero was there too, with Barnett Rubin. The CIA assessed with high confidence that the prisoners, absent some control on their movements, would seek to return to the war. And the agency also had concerns that even if they were banned from travel outside Qatar, they might be used by the Taliban for fundraising purposes. Johnson said he had received assurances from the highest levels of Qatar, meaning from the Emir himself, that the five prisoners would not return to violence, nor threaten the United States or its allies. Their families would come to live with them and would provide information. Cotter would watch their associations and place the five into some kind of ideological rehabilitation program, reporting every 2 weeks. None of these individuals